Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the FCC, especially to our guests from the Asia Society. We hope that this will be the first of many collaborations in between our two societies. As you, our own guests, are familiar with what we do on these occasions, first of all, we'd ask you please to turn off your mobile phones. And then what we do is invite our speaker tonight, who is a renowned journalist and professor of investigative journalism from Columbia University, Sheila Coronel, to talk to us about politics in the Philippines. I won't go over the same ground as Jean Ho did earlier on, but all that remains for me to say is you're very welcome. After Sheila has spoken, we will have a period for questions, during which time Sheila will probably sit there and take the questions. So one of the staff will pass around the microphone. All we would ask is that you introduce yourself when you ask a question so that we know who you are, and then Sheila will answer. So, I give you Sheila Coronel. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Anna. I don't do very well behind podiums. I hope you can see me. Thank you for being here tonight. Let me start by saying that not many Filipinos would have thought just 13 months ago that Ninoy Aquino would be president today. He was senator at that time, but then he was not, he was a lackluster legislator, to put it frankly. He was not exceptionally brilliant. He was not a movie star like many members of the Senate were. He was not a boxer like Manny Pacquiao. Although he came from a wealthy family, he was not exceptionally wealthy like the other would-be contenders during that time. But the death of Corazon Aquino on August 1st, 2009, changed all that. Hundreds of thousands of Filipinos came to her funeral and attended her wake. There was such a massive outpouring of emotion over her death. It was a mixture of grief over the passing of a democracy icon, but also a sense of nostalgia for 1986, because Cory Aquino represented people power in the Filipinos' great shining moment. 1986, the People Power Revolution was like Philippine Camelot. It was our brief, shining moment. But also a lot of introspection about what have we become? What had Philippine democracy become 20 some years after? That event galvanized what I would call the People Power constituency. This was middle classes, mainly in Manila and the other big cities, who had taken part in the movement against Marcos. They were professional people, business people, university students. They were people from what we call in the Philippines civil society, NGOs. They were people who had taken part in the social movement, in the movement against dictatorship and for democracy. The timing of Cory's death was fortuitous. It came about 9 months before the elections. And because this constituency had been fatigued by their own attempts at people power and had been frustrated by what people power had brought, regimes that really did not change very much, they saw the elections as a way to coalesce and to mobilize. And they saw Benigno Aquino as the rightful political heir of the democracy icon, Cory Aquino. And so it was Benigno Aquino who won by an overwhelming margin, one of the biggest margins ever in Philippine history, and is now president. There is, in Manila these days, such optimism. A recent poll said that 88% of Filipinos believe there is hope for this country. That is a very large number, considering that in March, just a few months, March this year, only 17% said that there was hope for the country. So there is now this optimism and hope that the Philippines has another fresh start, a new opportunity to bring about the changes that everyone agrees are long in coming. Benigno Aquino started his presidency by making very symbolic, doing symbolic acts, like not having sirens in his car when he was driven to his inauguration. He even told the crowd that gathered there, I have experienced all these people, you know, showing off their power with their silence. I know what it's like. This government is not going to be like that. This government will be different from the past. His slogan, you know, when he said, walang, the eponymous walang wang wang, which means in Tagalog, no more sirens, until now people are talking about it. It's a very simple act, but it carried so much weight in the Philippines, where there's been so much arrogance and abuse of power. Let me give you, before I go on, just a brief background about corruption in the Philippines. It is a big problem. Let me just give you a sense of the scale. 10 years ago, the Ombudsman, which is the anti-graft body in the Philippines, said that in the 20 years, from 1980, which was still the Marcos era, to 2000, the country lost $48 billion because of corruption, exceeding the foreign debt at that time of $40.6 billion. The Department of the Budget estimates that 20% of the budget, of the procurement budget, is lost to side payments every year. These are huge numbers, but they are different in scale also from Marcos-era corruption. Post-democratic corruption, while pervasive and significant, is not quite Marcosian in scale. Marcos, after all, created monopolies. He and his cronies took over businesses. He imposed levies that went to his own family and his cronies. This is not the same scale. President Estrada, who was ousted because of corruption in a people power uprising in 2001, was said to have accumulated something like $70 to $80 million in his 2.5 year presidency. That's nothing compared to the $5 to $10 billion that Marcos, that the Marcos family, was supposed to have squirreled away in Swiss bank accounts, real estate in New York, expensive art, etc. So the scale of post-Marcos corruption is not quite the same because obviously democratic presidents have a fixed term and they do not have the same powers that Marcos had. However, the scale is large enough to be concerned about. We've had predatory presidents. President Arroyo and President Estrada before her took cuts from illegal gambling. They took money from government contracts, or allegedly took money from government contracts and from the sale of government assets. The Philippines has this weird provision that says any contract that's worth more than $1 million has to be approved by the office of the president. And so that presents opportunities for presidents to dip their hands into the pockets of government contractors. This president will be different. It will not, Aquino's will not be a predatory presidency. Most Filipinos believe he is an honest man. He will be an honest president like his mother was. That by itself is a big improvement from the past. But at the same time, this president faces formidable challenges. So far he has said, among the things that he's going to do is, one, set up a truth commission to go after the wrongdoing of the past, to go after corruption charges during the Arroyo presidency. He set up this commission because the office of the ombudsman is controlled by a lackey of President Arroyo. And the ombudsman has a fixed term and she cannot be replaced. So he set up an independent commission to do an accounting of the wrongdoing of the past. He said he will go after tax collectors. He's directed his finance secretary to file cases every week against people like, you know, in his State of the Nation address, he talked about this pawn shop owner who drives a Lamborghini but doesn't pay his taxes. So he said cases will be filed against people like those. Tax collection is a big problem in the Philippines. It's now less than 15%. Our tax revenues are less than 15% of GDP. Transparency International said in 2000 that for every 2,000 pesos of taxes due, only 1,000 pesos is collected. 500 pesos is lost to corruption and 500 to inefficiency. So this is now the priority of the new government. President Aquino has also said he will examine the perks of government officials, and he gave the example of the board of the Manila Water Water Supply Company, who pay themselves huge benefits but cannot pay the pensions of their retired employees. That agency is in charge of the Manila watershed, and he said the board members built themselves mansions on the watershed despite that being illegal. So he said no more of this work. He also said he will clean up contracting and procurements. He said he will look at public works and clean up road projects. So these are a whole slew of reforms. What he has going for him is not just the vast well of popular support, but also he's appointed some of the most honest and skilled professionals in the country in his cabinet. His goals, when you look at it, are not terribly ambitious, but there are obstacles, real obstacles, to reform in the Philippines, obstacles that have faced other presidents in the past. First and foremost is the concentration of power in the country. A few hundred families control political power in the Philippines. They've done so for the last 100 years. The Aquino family is one of them. Benigno Aquino's grandfather, Serviliano Aquino, was a delegate to the 1898 Congress. They've been in power except for the 20 years that Marcos declared, you know, when Marcos was a dictator. But they've had people in public office for the last 100 years. Their family is not different from many others. The latest count is that 120 families have controlled a municipality, a district, or a province uninterruptedly for at least a decade. Many of these families have controlled these areas for 3 or 4 generations. The most outstanding example of this would be the Ampatuan family, same family that was responsible for the massacre in Maguindanao that killed 60 people last November. The Ampatuans have 15 members who were recently elected to public office in the last election. They fielded 60 members of their clan to public office in what they call strategic redundancy. They actually asked family members to run against each other, so to increase the chances of one of them winning. The Singson family, Singson is congressman of Ilocos Sur, and his son was recently arrested in Hong Kong for possession of cocaine. He has 10 members in various political posts. 62 families won 2 or more political posts in this last election. The problem with these families is not only have they resisted reform, they have resisted even following the law. The Ampatuans actually thought they could get away with murder, and they nearly did. Can President Aquino implement his reforms without the resistance of these families? Will these families start paying their taxes and acceding to many of the cleaning up the bureaucracies that have benefited them so much? The families have a stranglehold of Congress. 7 out of 10 members of the newly elected House of Representatives come from political families. Congress has traditionally been conservative in the Philippines and has been the main obstacle to reforms that the former president had wanted to implement. President Ramos, when he became president in 1992, tried not to involve Congress in his reforms, like opening up telecommunications industry by issuing executive orders, because he knew that these reforms would be blocked by Congress. Congressmen remain in power through a system of patronage that goes like this. In 1998, my organization did a study of what we call pork barrel funds. These are discretionary funds given to members of Congress for their district. We found that for public works projects that are funded by pork barrel funds, only 64% went to the actual project cost. 16% went to the congressman, 7% went to the village headman or the barangay captain, 3% to the city engineer, and so on down the line. So there is this network of corruption where a host of people benefit, and there's everyone is complicit. There is a sort of social contract here that someone powerful will share the benefits of corruption in different amounts, varying depending on their power, all the way down to the ordinary voter, who can then approach a congressman and ask for money for burying a relative, sending a child to school, etc., etc. So everyone is complicit in a very intricate system of patronage and corruption that is very, very difficult to break. This is why the history of previous attempts at reform in the Philippines has been a mixed one. It's mixed because it's very hard to go against this patronage network. Reforms can be done. Cory Aquino demonstrated this in 1986 when she cleaned up the Commission on Elections. Cory, as you know, was the victim of a fraudulent election. Marcos cheated her out of victory. So one of her first acts was to put professional men and women in the Commission on Elections. 2 years later, the Philippines had its first election. We had the cleanest election we've had in years. It can be done. Over the years, however, the Commission Elections has been politicized. People who were tied up with patronage relationships to presidents were appointed to office, and the credibility and efficiency and respect for that office has diminished. So reforms can be done, but they need to be sustained. Lesson number one. Lesson number two, there can be real bureaucratic resistance to reforms. In 2003, President Arroyo tried to clean up the Bureau of Internal Revenue, which is the tax collection agency in the Philippines, by appointing a former telecommunications executive. This guy tried to examine the lifestyles and the wealth and that, you know. They say in the BIR, which is the tax collection agency, the first indication we have of corruption is to look at the parking lot of the office, and you'll see all the BMWs and the Mercedes-Benzes owned by officials who earn less than $10,000 a year, $10,000 a year. In 2003, we followed around some of those officials. We did go to the parking lot, we looked at their houses, etc. We found, for example, a regional director of the revenue office earning less than $6,000 a year, who owned houses in some of the poshest villages in Manila. We went to his house, we saw two Mercedes-Benzes, two SUVs, his and her vanity plate, so they couldn't deny that they owned it, you know, because they had their initials on the license plates. Our check with travel agencies and immigration records show they and their families went overseas trips. So these were, the posts in the revenue agency are so lucrative that people try to stay there forever. We found in our search at least 24 officials who petitioned the Civil Service Commission to change their birth dates so that they would not have to retire so early. So that this is the nature of the agency. Anyway, in 2003, President Arroyo appointed someone who was willing to shake up the system. He eventually got booted out of office. The BIR Employees Association ran full-page ads in newspapers accusing him of helping the telecommunications company he used to work for evade taxes when he was their chief financial officer. They got their allies in Congress to initiate an investigation into this executive's previous history when he was in that telecoms company. They got their allies in the media to put him down. In the end, the guy was hounded out of office, disappointed, despaired, and totally disillusioned with government because there was so much resistance within the agency that he tried to reform. So these are the sorts of obstacles that any reformist, I mean, President Aquino did appoint a crusader to head the revenue office, but these are the sort of obstacles she's going to. These obstacles can be met if there is public support. The constituency behind Aquino is an urban middle-class constituency that toppled Marcos and toppled Estrada. The Philippines is a small but influential middle class. The estimate is that up to 12% of the population can be classified as middle class. It's small. In Manila, they say about a third of people living in Manila can be classified as middle class, and this is why many of the social, the movements for social reform are actually centered around Manila. This class has been very influential. It's in media, it's in NGOs, and it's in universities. They are also formed the new reform-oriented political parties. They're in environmental movements, they're in women's movements, they're in healthcare, and they're also in the Catholic, you know, vast Catholic Church charities. This middle class has been very influential as opinion makers, and they really formed the bulwark of Aquino's constituency, just as they did for Cory Aquino's constituency. But this class is untested. It's been proven to be very good at toppling presidents. It does not yet have a track record of implementing and sustaining reforms over a long period of time. This is the constituency behind Aquino. It's a powerful constituency. A lot of my friends belong to this. They're very nice, personable people. You like them. But they have been not shown a capacity for sustained reform. Ultimately, Aquino's success rests on the strength of this untested constituency. It is his main weapon that he can wield against the vested, long, entrenched interests in the country. The problem is that, you know, there is a much wider problem here. The Philippines is an inequitable society. 30 million Filipinos live below the poverty line. The richest 20% get 55% of the national income. Poorest 20%, only 5%. This makes the mass of Filipinos, you know, to them, they're attracted to populist appeals like the sort that Joseph Estrada exerted. Joseph Estrada in this election came far second to Aquino. So this middle class constituency has to fight against the appeals of populist presidents, will appeal to the poor, because so far, you know, democracy, the fight against corruption, has not really generated real benefits for the poor. Philippines is very much a class divided society. The middle class finds itself caught between the very entrenched elites and the masses of the poor. They need to be able to address, during Aquino's six-year tenure, they need to be able to address some of the discontent from the bottom, as well as fight the resistance from the top. It's a very tough task. What the Philippines actually needs is a new social contract. So far, the social contract that wields the country together and explains some of the resilience of Philippine society, it's a contract that basically says this: the rich and the powerful can steal as long as they share their loot with the others. Even if the poor get just a small amount of that, as long as they share, it's okay. The system holds. This contract has made it, this sort of social compact has made it possible for Philippine society to basically remain fundamentally unchanged in the last 100 years. A real reformist government must change the basis of our relationships with each other. It must forge a new social contract based not on sharing, not on this Robin Hood, not on this theory of the rich stealing as long as they share with the poor, but based on a really more democratic ethos where everyone shares the benefits of prosperity, where people get their share of the country's wealth according to their merit, according to the efforts that everyone follows the rules. It is very difficult to do that. Even the middle class itself is conflicted. Many of the professional people, doctors, lawyers, who live in these nice villages in Makati and who voted for Aquino, and who went out to the streets against Marcos, against Estrada, don't really pay the real taxes. They're tax evaders as well. That's the thing. The middle class benefits from a system that's inequitable and unjust and corrupt. We all do. And unless we are all willing to sacrifice part of those benefits for the share of the larger society, for the sake of the larger society, there can be no real reforms in the Philippines. The tasks that face Noynoy Aquino are formidable, and it's unfair, I think, to put in one man, in the hands of one man, an untested politician, well-meaning by all accounts, sincere by all accounts, to put on him the burden of reforming a society that's really rotten from top to bottom. Every Filipino has to play a role in this change. And if Benigno Aquino can do this, but he needs a lot of support, and there will be a lot of resistance. My best case scenario is this. Noynoy Aquino will be able to do incremental reforms, not do a drastic overhaul. He may improve corruption in certain government agencies. He may chip away a little bit at the patronage system, but there will be no drastic reforms. But there will be enough success to be able to elect an equally reformist president to succeed him, so that bit by bit, he chip away at the edifice of wealth and power that has held back the country for so long. If he fails, I think he will pave the way for another Joseph Estrada, or another populist type of president who will capture the imagination of the masses through populist appeals, but not really make much change. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sheila. Now, for questions, if you're ready with the box as well. There's one.
Good evening. I'm very impressed with your presentation. My name is Julian Russell. I'm just a guest here. I wish to ask a difficult question. Is there anything in your background and context to make a comparison between the Philippines and the situation in Indonesia and Thailand? Is the Philippines different from Indonesia and Thailand? Have you context to make such a comparison?
I think there is a great deal of similarity among those three countries. Of course, the sizes of the economies are different. In terms of the populist appeals of politicians, for example, I think there is a great similarity. There is, you know, between Thaksin and Estrada, in terms of the populist appeal. I think in many of the democracies in the region, there is a real danger of populist leaders being empowered, because the democracies so far in Southeast Asia have not really been able deliver services to the poor. We have not the most inequitable societies in Southeast Asia. I've looked at the World Bank figures, I looked at the Gini coefficients of the democratic societies. This is the paradox. Singapore is a much more egalitarian society on the nation compared to Vietnam and Laos, compared to Indonesia, Philippines, or Canada. I think the big failure of Southeast Asia in its inability to address social inequities. Similarities also in the patterns of corruption, at least in the previous regimes before democracy, hard for Marcos and all that. Similarities in the way there's plenty, but I would suggest, though, that between compared to the Philippines and the Thailand, the Thai middle class and the Thai Democrats have really messed up this one. Whereas the Democrats and the middle class in the Philippines were given a fresh chance with Aquino. I think the events post-Taksin and this whole controversy now see a way. Most promising democracy in Southeast Asia, it no longer is. I think Indonesia is, and I don't exactly know why. When be much more pernicious. But so far it's managed to hold together under the president who's done some reforms, not completely solved corruption in Indonesia, but I think they're making strides. It's a little bit like the SBY is like the Ramos of Indonesia. The question is, like Ramos, would SBY pave the way for the populist successor, like Estrada? Is there an Estrada way to win the race in Indonesia?
Thank you.
Since we're sitting next together, sitting next to each other, we both, I guess, have the first questions. My name's Edith Terry, and I grew up largely in the Philippines. My father was a U.S. Foreign aid officer, and so when I was a child, I was actually in the Aquino's home. Anyway, I heard a lot about the economy of the Philippines. So you've given me one good piece of news, which is that income inequality has actually dropped since the period of the 60s when the Philippines was relatively successful compared to other developing economies in Asia. The question is, what do you think accounts for the persistence of this system of basically the feudal system in which you have regional entities, regional families that are the major sort of conveyor belts for wealth and success? That was a story in the 1960s, and it doesn't seem to have changed since then. So they're both external and internal factors that would account for that persistence, and I wonder what you think they are.
I think one big factor really is the election system in the Philippines, which is basically district-based, because the families are based in districts, and if you have control over that district, then you basically retain power in that district over several generations. So there have been some attempts to reform the states with proportional representation so that Congress is not just made up of district-based congressmen. There's been a party list system instituted where marginalized groups can set up political parties and be elected not on the basis of districts, but districts. Congressional districts remain sort of the bastion of feudal family power in the Philippines, and especially in the House of Representatives. So unless we reform the election system so that there's less power put in district-based representatives, then we will continue to have families dominating at least Congress. That I think is a major reason.
Yes, John Davis, and I'm an interested observer. Can I ask you a question I've always wanted to ask somebody after visiting Manila and going through the shanty towns? Why has there never been a Marxist revolution in the Philippines, given the conditions that you talk about? What is different about the Philippines as compared with Cuba before Castro?
There's not much. I mean, you could say that of many countries in the world, like India, where you see massive poverty and massive inequities of wealth. One reason is the Marxism in the Philippines basically botched it and came very close to grabbing power in 1986. They've since divided and split up, and they haven't quite known how to react to a democratically elected government. But the other reason is that, as I said, the system of patronage is so receding, because the poor themselves become complicit in this corrupt system, because they derive benefits from it no matter how small those benefits are. They see that they can still go to their congressman's home, knock on their door, and not be turned away, and ask for a job. I once went to the office of the provincial governor, and he was there, and he spent the entire morning signing recommendations for jobs, calling up people to get someone's son who didn't make it to a college to be accepted. And all sorts of the strangest requests. One congressman told me, that he would get calls at 2 a.m. saying, "My caravan, water buffalo, got lost, and can you help me?" So the congressman is like, and he did, because it's a constituent, it's a voter. The congressman is like a welfare agency. He may be corrupt, he may be stealing, like the Ampatuan. been building these large fortified mansions with arsenals of high power weapons. But when you go knocking at their door, you basically get your advice answered. So this is why the system is strongly resilient. And it's not just, I'm sorry, when I answered the previous question, it's not just the electoral system, but the whole patronage system, where everyone is connected in some way. It's both the strength of Philippine society, this connectedness, but it's also, it's really, it's utter weakness.
I'm also a not so neutral observer because I'm married to the country. And also have to be very careful because many of the people we're talking about today are relatives. So I don't want to go down there with the bulletproof vest. My observation of the Philippines, having been married to the country for 40-odd years, is it's classified as one word. It's called family-style anarchy. I mean, democracy itself is something that you sprinkle on top of the cake, which is given to them by the Americans and call them democracies and so on. As a country, it really does not work because the kind of patronage systems and so on is very Malay-based system. So you have to go back to under the cultural roots of the Philippines, the sultanates and so on and so forth. You know, and this wonderful thing called Mabuhay, which you go in, everybody come to help you to build the house and you're obliged and so on.
Bayanihan.
The Bayanihan, yeah. I call it Banana Han. Yeah. So Philippine next year, for me, is nothing but a piece of South America drifted to Asia by mistake. Because same sort of observation. I said, if I'm young enough, I would do a thesis in Colombia, following you, and get my PhD on my thesis, is that the Philippines is very similar, not to Indonesia, Malaysia, and so on, but to Argentina, Paraguay, you know, there you are. So the family itself, you cannot get rid of. The 100 people, 100 families, and so on. So here comes the question, why is not a Maoist revolution in the Philippines? Every time I go down there, when I have 2 minutes outside the airport, I feel like I should do a revolution down here. As a Chinese, it's habitual, actually. As a Cantonese, we are habitual. We always like the organized revolution. The inequity in that country drive me lulu, is the word. Because this is a shame to my mind to call the country a democracy, because you're not. The country is so wonderful people, warm, as you said, the middle class people, hardworking, loving, capable. You have more MBA from Harvard than the whole population of Changzhou here. And how come the country is like this and so on? And listening to you tonight is, in fact, is a very revealing, because you give me some really very vital statistics. It depresses me like hell, because I had hope before, but after listening to you, it's just, my hope is still diminished by at least 20%. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm Tim Bruce. I'm a member of the FCC, just interested. You've talked about the executive and the problems there and the legislature. And you pointed out that at the moment there's a number of cases being made every week. But you haven't talked about the judiciary and what is the state there. And does that not have to be tackled first?
Yes, I didn't talk about the judiciary, that's true. Yes, I believe that the two essential reforms in the country are changing the electoral system and two, cleaning up the courts. A lot of the problems in the country can be traced to the corruption and inefficiency of the Philippine judiciary. And corruption goes, again, top to bottom from the Supreme Court all the way down to the local courts. Problems with the court, I mean, many years ago, during the Aquino era, sent one of the most credible Filipinos, Heidi Orap, to go around the country to look at the roots of rebellion in the Philippines. And the number one reason that they found out why people were picking up arms is that they couldn't get justice any other way. So the lack of justice, the lack of the rule of law, is really at the root of all the rebellions and the corruption in the Philippines, because, you know, if people think they can get away with murder or corruption, then there really is no stopping them from committing murder and doing corruption. So yes, we need to clean up the courts, and that's a fundamental reform.
President Aquino has not mentioned the tradition. I have no idea why he has not. Maybe he doesn't want to telegraph his moves. I know that he's refused to take his oath before the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court because the Chief Justice was seen to be in a lackey of President Aquino. So maybe he's respectful of the separation of powers. But certainly, yes, judicial reform is priority. One positive thing is that he's appointed a very good person as the Justice Secretary, someone who said that she would clean up and go after grafters and murderers and everyone. So that has there's reason to be optimistic. To your point, I think there is reason to be optimistic. I mean, I'm Filipino and I sort of the same bipolar disorder, you know, swinging from depression 6 months ago to optimism now. This optimism is palpable in me. When you talk to people there, they really think there's going to be real change in points, and that's nothing to be scoffed at. There may be no basis for it, it may be because Filipinos are hopeless political romantics. We want to believe, we want to be swept off our feet. And this is why we keep taking part in uprisings and so on, because we believe we are taken in by the emotion and the passion of the moment. And I can sense that there is such emotion, there is such passion for reform. And that is certainly something that this president can work on.
Stuart Stoker, member of the FCC. You've talked about the hope and the expectation that Aquino will transform the Philippines as president, but you've also said, correctly, that he's been an entirely lackluster senator. Doesn't he need to transform himself? And what is it that makes you think that he will or can?
He's a little bit like his mother. You know, Cory was, as she described herself, a housewife who became president. And the office transformed her. The circumstances transformed her into, you know, for all her faults, she did manage to stay in power. And she did remain committed to some idea, no matter how vague, of Philippine democracy. This Aquino is very much like his mother. The same sort of unassuming. I think what makes me confident he can is because I think the genius of the Aquino family is that they are able to address themselves to the common folk. Cory Aquino did that very well. You know, when she went around the country in 1986 and told the crowds, and there was like utter silence in the crowds, and she said, "I am like you, I am a victim of Marcos." Everyone was crying. The truth is, she's not like us. She's rich, she's wealthy, you know, she comes from two powerful political parties. Not all of us own 6,000 hectares of sugar land, right? But she managed to do that. When Noynoy Aquino said in his inauguration, "I may be born to famous parents, but I can feel the pain of ordinary people," he really touched a chord there. So I think in terms of, sounds trite, but feeling the pain, being able to identify the common folk and capturing the imagination of people, the Aquinos, because of their family history, are able to do that. I mean, it's something that no one else can, no matter how brilliant. I mean, no other person can do it because they're not an Aquino, no, because their father was not martyred, because their mother didn't become president. So it's different. I mean, the virtue of his family name, his family history, carries a lot of weight.
So if there's a question there, it's what would such a system look like if there could be because if you ask why is there corruption in the judiciary, one of the major reasons you find it anywhere is here. Because if the judge feels that he or she cannot give an impartial judgment without paying a personal penalty, then you may as well take the inducement that's positive as suffer the inducement that's negative. And I think unless you have a system where judges can feel that they have personal security and can reach informed judgments based on facts and not other factors, it's pretty much a hopeless situation.
Your first question, is there an alternative to the families? Well, not all families are the same. There are good families and bad families. There's the Aquino family and there's the Ampati ones. They are both political families, have been in power for a long period of time, have total control of their provinces or their districts, but they are different. Yeah, but I'm saying is that good families can be, there are reform-minded families who realize that the system is unsustainable, that if families are to survive, they have to change as well. So Aquino can ally himself with those families, and in fact, he has. There's a number of those families now who are much more, I wouldn't call them reformers so much as modernizers. They believe this feudal system is unsustainable and it's bad for everyone because it's a real impediment to the growth and prosperity of the country. And so what we need to do is to get out of this and have something that's more based on meritocracy and the government. So they're a modernizing constituency. So that, and they're powerful force, and that can be your sort of alternative to the feudal that balance. Your second question, security of judges. I think it's much more than security. It's also support from the top. If the Supreme Court, which is supposed to be the administrative judiciary, runs a tightership and says, you know, we will support the judges no matter what. You know, it's not just security, but also resources, etc. for judges. Then yes, there can be reforms. If they go after erring judges and really fight cases against judges who get bribes, then there can be reforms in the judiciary. If they launch investigations into corruption allegations and so on, then the problem is the Supreme Court does not have the high ground because itself it's been hounded by the charges of corruption. So there can be, in the judiciary, I think there can be reforms from the top. The top is clear.
Not to overrun too much. I think we'll have maybe three more questions. So one over here.
Okay. Can I ask, did you vote for Nonai Aquino?
No, I was in New York at the time. I wasn't able to register. I'm sorry. But I would have probably voted.
But not for Gibo Tagioro or Mani Villar, one of the others.
No.
Okay. Second question, if I may. Do you think that Nonai should address high-level corruption, the multi-billion peso scams?
Of his predecessor?
Today.
Should he
address the high-level corruption, or should he try and address the low-level corruption that exists at the level of the police force, the customs, etc.?
This is a tough question that's always, you know, reformers in whatever country, do you go for the high-level political corruption or do you go for the low-hanging fruit? I have no easy answer for that. Maybe the low-hanging fruit would be easier at this stage when you want immediate impact that's felt. You know, if you clean up the police, for example, and say GP drivers, no longer feel that they're being extorted from by the police, then maybe there's much more direct impact on the ordinary Filipino than there is if you clean up contracting, because you won't see the impact of that. You won't feel it directly immediately. So there is some virtue in going after the low-hanging fruit, I think. It's only to demonstrate that corruption can make an impact, reform can be done, and it can have an immediate impact.
Isabel Escoda, compatriot. Regarding the question of that gentleman about why we don't revolt, why haven't people revolted,
would you say that a lot of it rests on the fact that we are very fatalistic people, extreme religious, and we know that if we don't get what we need now, it'll come to us later in another life? Secondly, you didn't touch on the fact that Corey, though she may have cleaned up COMELEC, the Commission on Elections, she was a total failure when it came to what she called the platform of her administration, which was land reform. Why did she fail there? And finally, Noinoy, being part of the elite, has he gotten grassroots people around him, like Kapatiran and Gawad Kalinga, to really help out, because they know what the people really need?
Okay, the first question, is it because you're fatalistic? You can also add fun-loving, karaoke bars, and so on. But I don't really think that national character or whatever is the determining feature, because if you look at Philippine history, we've actually been revolting quite a lot. I mean, against the Spanish regime, there have been hundreds of small revolts. And, I really blame more the family connections. Like, even in the Communist Party, you know, they don't go after family members. In the military, they release family members who are communists and so on. It's really more the interconnectedness that keeps the society together and prevents, you know, rupture in the society. It's the family and religion, yeah. It's a whole slew of factors. Your second question about Corey Aquino, yes. Corey didn't institute land reform, partly because her family is one of the biggest landowners in the country, and partly because Congress would not allow it. Even if she had wanted it, Congress, which is composed of land-owning political families, would not have legislated it. The third was grassroots. He does. I mean, all of these, Dawid Kalina and all these other people, people involved in urban poor housing projects. Yes, there is deep support among those people for, I mean, he won with 15 million votes. I mean, the middle class isn't that big in the Philippines. So there was mass support for him as well.
Okay, I think we'll take a few more questions and then we'll invite Mr.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, please. Yeah?
Yes, I'm Jane Singer with Inside Fashion. First of all, I concur with the Chinese gentleman who spoke earlier with regard to the Philippines being a bit more like Latin America in terms of the nature of things. And I think that, you know, I'd just like to ask you, obviously, they need, for Aquino to be able to put through the kind of reforms that he wants to do, he's going to need more than that 12% middle class to make that happen. He's going to need that big constituency at what you call the poverty level. And I'm just wondering how much of those people are being sort of, if you might call, mitigated by the system of remittance. And I say that because you have relatives who go overseas and are willing to work their tail off and send everything back while hundreds of people lie about. And you wonder if any of them would get off their butts and earn a living and be part of moving forward. Those are the people, I would believe, who you'd need to gain some kind of power. And yet, you know, you sort of create a malaise when there isn't that impetus to move forward, because there is a plan B, albeit you're not going to get rich living off remittance. But it's like what we have in our country. I'm from the States, which is welfare. There are people who are career welfare. You know, you don't get ahead, but you're okay. You know, it's okay. You hang out, you enjoy, and the next generation, it goes on and on.
You're quite right. In fact, a prominent former Marxist once said that it was overseas immigration that took the sail out of revolution in the Philippines, because immigration was a safety valve. It was an outlet for people's discontent in their own societies. Instead of taking up arms, you can line up in an embassy and get a work visa to go somewhere. In fact, it is. I mean, it's provided a way for people who think they will not progress in the country, for frustrated and dissatisfied, to go elsewhere and see greener pastures outside. And it's really, I mean, it's also decimated the middle class, because I would say like a
1/3 of the Filipino middle class is actually overseas, not in the Philippines. And that's also diminished the constituency for these kinds of reforms. Some people say that immigration is that, overseas immigration is like a resource curse. You know, it's like having oil. You become dependent on it. And you don't do the reforms that are necessary because there's always those foreign remittances on which your economy can rely. You don't have to redistribute land or to clean up government because there's always this assured pool of funds. Overseas remittances are the biggest source of foreign exchange. Right, it is a big factor when you look at your calculus of the society. What factors keep it together over overseas regions is a major factor.
Democracy. Really quickly, I'm Jeremiah Marquez. I'm a FCC member. I'm wondering whether you think that there's a role to play for any foreign governments, whether the policies of any foreign governments could change or be amended in any way to help Aquino. And the same, I would ask the same about any international bodies.
Yes, I mean, Aquino does deserve the support of the foreign community in terms of, you know, better trade, investments, aid. I can't think of, I don't know any specific things that foreign governments could do, but certainly this president needs support, particularly for the reforms that he wants to do. So I know, for example, the EU has been giving support for judicial reform, and they've been very frustrated. I now think that there's real chance for having judicial reforms because the EU is particularly concerned about human rights issues. In reforms that he wants to do in the economy. I mean, there's a lot of technical and other expertise that can be lent, for example, in tax collection. Philippines really sorely needs to overhaul its tax collection system. It's inefficient by design. It's really designed for corruption. You know, thinking of a better way for to be track of and collecting taxes would be immensely helpful, especially now that the president said that's going to be his priority. And he said, we're going to set targets of tax revenue.
My name is Audi Lai. I would like to add in, you forgot to talk about the corruption of Ramos.
It's only given 35 minutes.
Yes, but you almost talk about everybody else except him. Don't forget, he privatized Fort Bonifacio, Billiamore Air Base, Clark Air Base, Camp John Hay, also the reclaimed land along Rojas Boulevard. That's so much more than the loot of the Marcoses in a matter of his one single term. Secondly, I'm from Tarlac. So this Aquino political dynasty, we're very sensitive about it. Don't forget, the Aquino name has a stain because the old Aquino collaborated with the Japanese. That's why whatever Benigno Aquino does, the presidency wasn't meant for him. It was meant for Acohuanco. And Cory is Acohuanco. So is Noynoy is also Acohuanco. I just want to put that straight because we are very sensitive on this issue. And my question is, lackluster as Noynoy is, and we all agree, the whole Philippine community agrees, if you are in front of Noynoy Aquino now, fighting corruption, what is the blueprint that you're going to present to him that will work for the next 5 years so that he can attain his promise to the Filipino people? That's my question.
Okay, first of all, on the corruption issues, as I said, no one comes close to Marcos in terms of the corruption. The scale and the techniques and the powers that Marcos has are completely different. So when you talk post-Marcos corruption, it's really of a different scale and magnitude and whatever. I don't know, I wish I had a blueprint for reforming Philippine society and then I can run for president. As I said before, cleaning up the justice system is key.
to courts, the instituting real rule of law is key, and there's a number of things that can be done to do that. Cleaning up the prosecutorial system, cleaning, you know, providing more resources for law enforcers, etc., etc. Cleaning up, naming new people to the Supreme Court and all that, but there are also real obstacles because you cannot just fire members of the Supreme Court. Second, I think seriously rethinking our system of representation, whether it's more proportional representation, less district, so that way people who don't belong to political families have a better chance. Three, rethinking campaign financing, because right now only rich people can run for public office. The cost of elections, especially of national elections, especially now with the cost of TV advertising, is massive. So there must be a way to equalize the playing field, even if that means, for example, providing subsidies for political parties and for candidates. Fourth, I think we need to... I think you need to demonstrate that reforms can be done in one place, whether that's the tax collection agency. You cannot reform all of society in one go. I would focus on a particular agency and institutional reforms that have an impact and show people it's a confidence building issue. Show people it can be.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Yuen. Professor Cornell, would you completely closed to you to enter politics?
I was just joking when I said I would run. No, I'm not a member of a political family, unfortunately. Not a movie star or a boxer.
And if someone had asked you to serve as well?
My name's Nellie Fong, and I'm the other half of the 40 years that my husband's been married to. I grew up in the Philippines. My family's Filipino. My grandfather was involved in the revolution, and my father in the movement for independence. My husband has always said, and we've always argued, he said there are three questions to ask in the Philippines, and actually in almost any society. What comes first, God, family, or nation? And I think we've been talking tonight about reforms, but you cannot really achieve reforms unless there's a totally different mindset in the nation. And I, of course, I'm hopeful. I have to be hopeful. I'm from the Philippines. But I think one of the things that's got to change is that we start thinking of ourselves as a nation and putting the nation first above the interests of a region. If you're Ilocano, you're Ilocano. You're from Tarlac, you're from Tarlac. If you're from Mindanao, from Visayas, this cannot be, really. How do we see ourselves as the Filipino people? How do we see ourselves as the Filipino nation? And great sacrifices have to be made. Sacrificing, you know, your region, your loyalty to your family, even, in order to achieve any of these reforms that we're talking about. And how do we change this mindset? I mean, I don't know. Maybe we have to have a majorly strong Bureau of Propaganda, if you want to use that word. I mean, media is propaganda, advertising is propaganda, but just to put forth the need for this sacrifice, this need for a sense of identity, a sense of national pride, you know, that we see ourselves as able, intelligent, future-seeing people, and not people who send overseas work, you know, our best just overseas to serve as workers overseas, to see ourselves constantly as a nation that is corrupt. We've got to see we look back in history at the sacrifices of our heroes, of those who died in the revolution, died during World War II. You know, and we've got to change our mindset. And for me, I don't know whether the media can do this, the schools, the education, and so on, so that never mind, and the church even, which is such a huge, strong influence. And actually, I mean, it's wonderful because it has we have had bloodless revolutions and coups, but at the same time, the church is such a strong patron. It's such a feudal organization still in the Philippines.
I think what we need to change is our patriotism. You know, even in our national anthem, you know, we say, you know, to die for our country.
You always have this romantic notion of what you do for your country is you die, you rise up, you revolt. Actually, what we need to do is build institutions. And it's harder work. It's less romantic. But it takes a lot of effort, and it takes really hard day-to-day work. That's where, you know, our being romantic goes against our being reformist. You know, Filipinos have died for the country. Filipinos have taken arms for what they see as their patriotic duty. But somehow, you know, rebuilding institutions, doing the daily work of governance is something that we don't like to do. It's too boring. And that's what we really need to focus on.
Okay, one more. Who's had a hand up long?
What Nelly was saying just now, the other half of the Chinese gentleman, Kenneth, who spoke earlier on, was very interesting in terms of national appeal. Is the Philippines today still a parochial society? Looking back at what Kenneth said, and it was a very revealing statement about the sultanates. Before the Spanish came 400 years ago, presumably the Philippines was organized into sultanate-type society, various tribes and various allegiances, but all very regional and very small. The Spaniards came, they brought Catholicism, they brought the church, but they did not bring administration which went down into the roots of the people. The people continued to be sultanate-oriented and parochial, and that continued through the American movement into democracy, where there were educated people who went to America and went to university and came back and fought for democracy, but they were basically the 100 families. The 100 families continued the parochial tradition. And there hasn't really been a real effort made to make the Filipinos respond to a national message. And that, I think, is probably one of the big problems. Do you see any truth in that?
FCC present.